ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Trina Falbe, an ethical experience design consultant, speaker, teacher, and author. And we're going to talk about ethical UX today. This episode is brought to you by Balsamiq, a low-fidelity wireframing tool. Basically, it's like sketching on a whiteboard, but on the computer. The idea is to get the structure of your user interface down before you start coding or sweating the details in Sketch. Try their new web app, Balsamiq Cloud, free for 30 days at balsamiq.cloud. Hi, Trina.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
We are so happy to have you. How about we start with a short questionnaire to learn about you and then jump to the main topic?
Sure.
So question number one is, what do you do for a living?
Well, I do a variety of things. Right now, I am teaching at a multimedia program where I teach UX primarily. And I also do consultancy in ethical UX design. And, you know, I've written a book recently and do all sorts of things that relate to UX.
Wonderful. A little bit of your background. How did you get there?
So I guess I didn't take the traditional route to a job. When I graduated from high school, I took an apprenticeship first in a sales and marketing department, and I worked there for 3 years at a newspaper. And then I went back to school and was taught some front-end development. So I worked as a front-end developer and usability consultant for a while. That was back in the day when we designed for screens that were, computer screens that were no larger than 640 by 480 pixels.
Right, so it's, remember it's, that time.
It's, yeah, so now we have that on our phones, right? But these were computer screens. So it's a while back. Then I actually started teaching front-end development and web design. And I also started on the side, alongside the teaching, I started doing various types of consultancy. I've always had a big passion for usability, even before the term user experience came along. I work with usability and did usability studies and usability enhancements for companies. So I've always had a passion of that. And then I started doing, proper UX consultancy when that term kind of came along. I also did a master's degree in interaction design while I was working. And recently I was involved with a digital startup for a year and a half as both as a UX consultant and also as a head of user insights. So I've done a lot of different things, and I didn't take the high school, university, job kind of route. I've taken some courses and educated myself over the years, which I found really, really, interesting. Because what I'm noticing is that, all the work experience that I have, when you then go back to school part-time, that the experience that you have really becomes very powerful and becomes a great facilitator for learning. Instead of only, having your own little box of knowledge when you are very young, I found that really, really powerful to actually be a professional and then doing training at the same time. So that's kind of my way into UX design, but I've really been working with usability and UX for a very long time, and it's something that's very close to my heart.
That's an amazing story. You've done it all kinds of UX things, both development and even sales, and you have an official degree afterwards. That's pretty amazing combination.
Yeah, I mean, it's when I look back at my my career path, I sometimes lose my breath a little bit because I'm thinking to myself, wow, it's a lot of things to take on, but it's really been interesting to kind of do that a little bit backwards, to not necessarily have the entire training bit at the beginning, but to broaden that out over a period of, you know, 10, 15 years. It's really been very helpful, I think, and something that others might also benefit from. You know, just because you turn 30 doesn't mean you can't go back to school, right? Doesn't mean that you stop have to stop learning in that respect.
Absolutely. What does your typical day look like?
Well, a typical day. So right now, being involved with the teaching at the academy again, a day could, you know, consist of getting up pretty early to get my kids ready for school. I also had two kids during all this time. So I get up and get my kids ready for school and usually drop them off. And then I will either go back home and work on some consultancy work, or I'll go to the academy and work, either teach or, you know, prepare for classes or have an exam or stuff like that at the academy. So that's usually my the way that I work. And I make it a point not to get home too late in the afternoon, because I want to spend time with my kids in the afternoon. So I often go back to work in the evening. I usually, you know, work a couple of hours in the evening. So that's kind of the way that works for me in terms of scheduling my day.
What kinds of work do you get to do, like, hands-on daily? Do you still do, you know, design or do the wireframes? What do you get to do for your clients?
So a variety of things, I would say. Both, you know, prototyping in terms of lo-fi prototyping, doing so developing products in that respect, but also lots of usability testing, research in terms of figuring out what, you know, how to create products that that are most usable and, you know, have the best experience for the people who are going to be using it. So that's kind of the main things I do as a UX designer or a UX researcher, is that I don't do UI design per se. I'm more turned towards the research side. So I do research and you know, bring that knowledge over to lo-fi prototypes that are then developed further on by a designer.
Wonderful. You recently published a book with two co-authors, I think.
I did, yes.
Yes, yeah, tell us a bit about that.
So, so that's been an interesting project. That has really, it took a lot longer than expected to write the book, actually, which was interesting. But that's actually because we took a very focused, you know, human-centered design approach to writing the book and to getting the book, you know, right and targeting it in the way that made most sense. But about a year ago, maybe even a year and a half, my friend Martin and I, one of my co-authors, decided that we wanted to write a book together. So my background is UX and Martin's background is IT development. So he's on the development side, but also on the business critical side. So so he works as a consultant and does basically does consulting that relates to building software and building IT, large scale IT systems. And so we decided that we wanted to write a book together about kind of an idealistic book on how to approach experience design in an ethical way. So we wanted to tell people and let people know that there is an alternative to black hat methods and to the increasing deception and manipulation that we see in digital systems that we are using. So we know that people are getting, you know, their data is getting tracked and their behavior is being monitored with the sole purpose of monetizing that information. And we wanted to write a book that presented an ethical alternative to that, to running a business, you know, in a in that way, because we know that it, you know, that it's, we are very convinced that that is going to be, if not the most important competitive advantage that you can, you know, put yourself in the future. People are going to get fed up with being manipulated and being deceived and being treated like livestock. So we wanted to present an alternative to that. And so we started writing, and then we quickly decided that we wanted to include a third co-author because we wanted the book to be very much focused on best practice and really presenting our information, our knowledge in the best possible visual way that we could. So we engaged with one of the best UI designers that we know and asked him if he wanted to join as a co-author. So he basically drew the entire book, illustrated the entire book. All our example work is illustrated by Kim, who is really, really good at doing really stellar UI design. And his focus has always also been on creating something that was beautiful, great experience, and usable and ethical. So that was kind of the combination. And we wanted to write the book for people who didn't necessarily have a UX background, because we know that more and more people in companies get to do UX without necessarily being trained in it. So if you worked in marketing, all of a sudden you have to also, can you do the UX for us? And everyone talks about UX. It's a new corporate language. So everyone talks about UX, but people who don't necessarily have training in it can find it really daunting to, engage in discussions with designers and stuff like that. So we wanted to write a book that equipped people with a good toolbox at the same time as, and that toolbox being a white hat toolbox. So basically teaching people the right approach to experience design rather than, getting all these really bad and manipulative habits that we also see happen in UX design.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about that a little bit later today in the episode. That's exactly why we got together. I would love to learn more about that. I have two more questions in the questionnaire left. And one is, what do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I don't know what I enjoy. I know what I enjoy the most. I enjoy most, interacting with people, getting into interesting discussions about, best practices, producing beautiful stuff, producing stuff that at its core is centered towards, creating an experience that enhances people's lives, that teaches children how to be creative, that, that's what I really enjoy the most. I guess I'm a little bit of an idealist. I like to think that the work that I do improve the experience of people's lives in larger or smaller scale. But that's what I enjoy the most. What I enjoy the least about my work, I don't know. I don't think there are things that I... Well, accounting.
Right. That's what everybody says.
Accounting is not my favorite thing. I have an accountant, though. I made
That's
it a
good.
Point to, yeah, I was thinking, so if I do what I do best and I let other people do what they do best, accounting is definitely not one of my, skills. So I outsource that and just pay the bill, basically. I think that's a good trade-off.
Wonderful. What is your next big thing?
I haven't really decided yet. So it's really been a crazy time. I was involved, as I said, I was involved as head of user insights in a digital startup that was not based in Denmark, where I come from, but based, had people employed all over the world, and the founders were based in Japan. So it was a pretty crazy time. It was super, super interesting. It also took up a lot of time. So I've actually enjoyed the past 3 months just being a little less hectic. and also with the book being finalized and stuff. So I, right now, you know, the holidays are coming up, so I'm going to enjoy those. And after that, I've actually considered starting up a new book project. I also have a UI project coming up, just a small scale, gig. But the next big thing I think might just be another book.
Wonderful. And you seem to be really enjoying that.
Oh, I love writing. It's really exhausting, but I love it. Also because it's super flexible. You can basically write anywhere. It's not, you know, you don't really have to have lots of equipment. And I've really enjoyed the process of writing something bigger than an article. It's also super, super hard because it's hard to get right and hard to create a piece that's sort of unified, a big piece of stuff that's unified and makes sense in the getting the order right in things. But I really enjoyed writing the book. So there just might be another book project coming up in 2018.
I'm totally here with you because I think since you're sitting down to write, it's almost easier to write something long form like a book because automatically you get that credit of user's attention, reader's attention. And while with articles, it's just such a short life.
It is, and it can't be too long because then you lose the attention of the people who are reading it, right? So it has to kind of be short and very to the point and skimmable because most articles or all articles these days are published online. So it also has to be, you know, nice to read on a screen, etc. I've really found the notion of writing chapters of stuff to be super interesting because it also allows you to dive in a totally different way than you can do in any, you know, web-based blog post or article, even a white paper.
Exactly. And blog posts, they have to be marketable by themselves, while in the book you can dive into a topic in a more useful way without having to make it attractive on its own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it all kind of relates to each other in a book, and you can kind of build up a story and build, you know, a platform of knowledge for people to bring forward in the next chapter. So I think it holds a lot of benefits to publish stuff in printed book form.
So let's go back to the main topic of our conversation, which is ethical UX, white hat UX. But I guess you can talk about white hat UX before pointing out the biggest problems of black hat UX. And you kind of skimmed on that talking about your book, which is, you know, when users are treated as live material for people's money, which is, I think, is totally horrible. So what are the biggest problems are happening here in the world of black hat UX?
So I think right now what's really becoming very apparent is that people's data are being mined in a way that is way beyond, you know, immoral. It's super unethical the way that people are being mapped and basically profiled. And we know that it's happening, but the problem is we can't really fully understand the depth of the problem because the companies such as Facebook and Google who hold all this data on us are not really willing to give that up and to disclose the way that they actually the way that their business model is actually put together. But what I'm really finding to be interesting is that with the GDPR that's coming up in May 2018, the general the new data protection law in the EU, is that is going to force companies to have a totally different type of transparency in the way that they harvest data. I actually noticed the other day when I think I was logging into Gmail in my browser for some reason. And I actually received a notification from Google that I had to read through new terms and conditions because according to GDPR of 2018, you can no longer, you know, hide hide all this information from users on how their data is being used and why it's being tracked in your terms and conditions. That's been, you know, common practice for almost every company or every corporation, that they just hide all the bad stuff in the terms and conditions because no one reads 200 pages of terms and conditions, right? But that's going to change. But that's definitely one of the biggest problems, because it also it makes us very, very vulnerable as people, because, you know, we see data leaks all the time. And I really think that that's it's very concerning that companies hold this kind of data on us, especially because most of them are not using it to do good. They're using it for monetary purposes. That's definitely one of the bigger issues in black hat's experience design or unethical experience design these days.
One question: why does it necessarily relate to actually experience design? Because collecting data and using it somewhere else in the business, it's not necessarily, you know, interferes with what the user sees or acts or somewhat. Is that because this data is used to manipulate user behavior in the other part of the app, for example?
Yes, I think that's a major issue. Mm-hmm. For instance, when you use Facebook and you see ads for stuff that you were mm-hmm. searching for in your browser, for instance, I think that's creepy to the extent that it's hard to really comprehend. So that's just one. That's where it becomes really apparent, right? But it's also, that we now there are all these indications that certain applications are actually listening into your conversations, and then exposing you to advertising that is designed to make you, you know, buy certain things based on the conversations you had offline. I think that's deeply unethical, and it's because it is trying to change your behavior online. It is trying to nudge you into doing stuff that you wouldn't, you know, normally do. So I think that's deeply concerning from an ethical perspective. I have no problem with data being collected if that data is being used to enhance experiences in a way that benefits, you know, the person using the system. For instance, if you track that someone is using one part of an app or a website more than another part of an app or a website, and you add, you know, short links to their favorites or whatever, I think that's a super good way to use data, you know, to track behavior and use that behavior to enhance the experience, because we know that, for instance, ease of use in terms of a system being fast to use, the faster and easier a system is to use, the more, you know, the better the experience. So that's super fine. But using data to make us buy more stuff, to, you know, basically just to increase consumerism, I have a big problem with that.
So besides the tricking the user into some commercial activities, what other things do you observe in this that people are doing wrong, and what you can call black hat UX practices?
So lots of things we see happen all the time. For instance, people signing up for stuff they didn't, you know, intend to sign up for. I actually just reviewed, this was a Danish e-commerce site the other day that, you know, where you can buy tons of different things, you know, all like a small scale Alibaba, right? And so you can buy stuff for really good prices, but then you realize, and people may not even realize, that you actually also, when you buy stuff, when you buy an item, you actually subscribe to, you actually sign up for a subscription, so they can charge you a monthly fee, because what they say is that this is like a customer club that you have to pay a monthly fee to be part of this club, so that you can get these good prices. And it's almost impossible to opt out. You actually have to call them physically on the phone, and you have like two or three time slots per week times 2 hours to call them and opt out of the subscription, which is very, very black hat and actually illegal, because you can't, you have to be very clear as to, if you ask people to sign up for something, it has to be very clear to them that they are actually signing up. But it's not, you're not really taking anything off that, okay, I want to be part of this club. You're just buying a product. And then, you know, when they have your product, they also have your, when you've bought a product, they have your credit card details. And storing those credit card details and using them for subscription purposes is another way to, you know, harvest data that that is unnecessary and super unethical. You can also find, you know, companies that if you buy a digital product, you buy an ebook, but they want your physical address. What do they need that for? I imagine that they can use it to send, you know, to first sell your address, but also to, you know, send you all sorts of physical material crap that you don't need, and newsletters that in that respect. And that's another way of using data, in a way that is not, for the, you know, for a good purpose for the person who's exposed to it.
That's a great example. And the first example you mentioned, I've heard a story of that taken to more extreme case when I think it was happening in Germany with some adult content providers. They would sign you up very easily, but in order to unsubscribe, you have to engage into back and forth physical mail with them. And those envelopes would be heavily branded with adult content stuff. And you don't really want to do that so that your neighbors or your family members see that. So people were legally, you know, blackmailed into keeping the subscription going with them. I think this is just outstandingly horrible.
Yeah, that's awful. That's awful. Oh my goodness. I hadn't heard of that case. It's
I'm not 100% sure, because I'm definitely not in Germany and it was just more of a UX story overheard. But yeah, if that's the case. One topic I would love to discuss with you. You're a parent yourself, and I know you've been involved into designing kids' UX. And kids are just over manipulated everywhere, in the App Store, on YouTube, everywhere. What is your take on that, and how can we protect our kids from being UX mistreated?
Yeah, I totally agree with you that our kids are exposed to a lot of things that they shouldn't be exposed to. So one thing is that, you know, from a content provider perspective, there is a big responsibility. I also think there is a parental responsibility to try to maybe protect our kids a little bit. And that's a lot easier said than done. I have two boys, and they both love YouTube to the extent that, you know, I'm thinking, wow. And YouTube, and so I can only protect them in the way that, you know, I can set up you know, filters in YouTube to make sure that they don't see, you know, content that's inappropriate for them. And I can, you know, set a limited amount of screen time and stuff like that. But it's not really realistic to sit next to them whenever they watch YouTube, right? I know that right. would be the ideal situation, that we would have that kind of time. But as parents, we don't, right? And whenever we hear about parents, or whenever we read an article, you know, suggesting, hey, why don't you sit down next to your child when they're on YouTube? You're thinking, right, who does that? I don't know anyone who does that.
Because that's why you have YouTube.
That's why you have YouTube, right? So that you can maybe have that 15 or 30 or 45 minutes, you know, to do something else. So I think we can only do so much as parents. And I really don't think that the right approach is to ban screen time, because that is going to be a handicap for our children growing up. You can only protect them totally for, you know, for a certain period of time. But we know that they are growing up in a digital era. So we need to also, train them in, you know, and train them in maneuvering in a digital era, So, and the right approach is not to ban screens at home, you know, thinking that that's going to make everything better. So from a content provider perspective, for instance, YouTube, I think there's a fantastically great responsibility for them to at least consider how, for instance, how that strict filter is working. From any other content provider's perspective, I think I would like to see more providers of content and for children that take on the responsibility of not exposing children to advertising, to actually create experiences that that help children learn and grow stronger and empower them, as opposed to just seeing them as consumers. I think right now a lot of content providers see children as consumers of content, and I think that that's totally wrong. I think there is also a great business case in seeing children as, you know, active participants and learners and people that you can help empower through content. I think that's a great business. I actually think that's a great business case, and I don't understand why so many companies take the other route. For instance, all the social media, Instagram, Facebook, etc. They say you can't have an account unless you're 13 or older. They know that tons and tons of kids have accounts, even though they can't, because, you know, they trick their way into doing that. And so they can basically just wash their hands and say, well,
we told you.
Yeah, it's the kids' own fault because, you know, they can't have an account. So they're doing something illegal and, you know, we can't do anything to control that. I'm getting upset about that because there is a lot of potential in teaching kids and really teaching them to become digital citizens if the providers of content and social platforms would just take that responsibility. So I'd really like to see that happen. That's why I loved working for Creatable so much. I was involved with them for a year and a half, and they are creating a social platform primarily for children with the purpose of nurturing creativity. And I think that's just such a wonderful mission, because they actually see children as more than just consumers, but they see them as, you know, people with the potential of learning. And I think that's much more interesting. And I think that's, I'd really like to see that happen more.
I have very high hopes that they don't have it for free, because one of my next questions is that the free model is flawed by default, and that signing up for free services, we kind of subscribe for being treated as, you know, all that black stuff we discussed above.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yes, I agree that 99 out of 100 cases, that is true. That when something is free, we know that it's not really free. We know that we pay with our data and with our, you know, minds, basically, and our freedom. But I'd like to bring a little more nuance to that entire notion, because I get that. I get that free is per definition not free, but the alternative is paying for your app, right? Paying for the service so that you don't have to get exposed to advertising. Having said that, a lot of services that actually have, you know, subscriptions that you actually pay for also provides advertising, right? They also take your data, even though you paid for the service. And I also think that it's a little bit of a privilege, right? If you are able to pay for a service, that's a privilege. Not all people have that privilege. And so in Europe, you know, the majority of people will have that kind of privilege. But there are tons and tons of places in the world where that privilege is not found. So they have to. They have no other option than using free services because they don't have the funds to pay for premium services. and, you know, the ad-free version. They just don't. So I don't necessarily believe in, changing from free versions to paid versions just to, and that solves all problems. I don't think it does. It would solve problems if providers and services that are free started looking into their business models, and instead of only trying to sell data to third parties and, you know, using advertising, maybe finding other alternatives. I don't have the answer. If I had the answer to what that would be, I would be a very rich person. But, you know, I just want to bring a little bit of nuance to the whole. We tend to feel that, you know, the free version is like the evil version, and we know that we pay with our blood, basically. But to a lot of people in the world, that's the only alternative they have. And I think that's important to understand as well.
Yeah, you're bringing up a lot of important things here. So going back from the black hat practice and back practices, as UX designers, what can we proactively do well to when we're building new services, when we're assisting founders in building something? What can we proactively do to ensure white hat UX in the new products?
So first of all, we can train our founders and train our management in establishing a user-centered focus. So and we can do that through getting them to understand and how, for instance, early and continuous user involvement actually improves the product. So we know that UX is actually that there is a strong business case towards focusing on UX, because, and that's one of the things that we actually mention and bring up in the book, is that we did a case calculation on how much it costs if an error is detected very late in the development process, as opposed to when an error is surfaced very early in the development process. And the cost of figuring out, you know, the longer it takes for us to detect an error, the more costly it gets, the more expensive it is. So if you start applying, you know, testing very early on, if you do prototype testing, you do user involvement, concept testing, and you realize errors at that stage, you can basically just go back and rewrite a spec, right? As opposed to if you notice a severe error 2 days before launch and the system has already been built, then it's really, really costly to correct. And very often, you know, it ends up not being corrected unless it's a bug. So so that's one of the things that we can definitely do as UX designers, is to make our founders and managers understand how it's actually a, you know, good business to involve users early on, to do continuous testing. And then once we, you know, once they understand that, that's at least my experience, is that once they understand that, they also start becoming open towards listening to people, you know, the end people that we design for more, because they see them more. They establish empathy towards them, because that's really one thing that we need to do more, is to empathize with the people that we. That we serve. The people, I'm trying not to say users, because a user is not, you know, the best term in terms of seeing the people that we serve as humans, as people, just like us. I think that's very, very important, to establish a greater sense of empathy. And we can do that by seeing people more and exposing our founders and managers to the users as well.
Yes, absolutely. What is your take on collecting different kinds of analytics of data yourself as a founder? You mentioned that using that to improve the UX is kind of white hat, is a good practice. But to what limit can we go while doing that? For example, one of the things that bothers me personally very much is the variety of tools that do, you know, direct screen recording of the user's experience, including whatever they do exactly in your app. Of course, seeing such walkthroughs can be very useful to see what they're struggling with, but at the same time, it's not ethical to kind of stand behind their shoulder without their consent. What is your take on that?
That's actually interesting. I think it's interesting that you say that it's not ethical to actually track what people do on the screen.
I don't have an answer.
I think that's a really interesting perspective. I don't think it's unethical if you do it for the right. I think the what makes it unethical is your motivation for doing so. If you track people with the purpose of, you know, getting them to buy more stuff, just with the purpose of getting them to do that or to stay longer by making flows, you know, longer or getting them to expose more data because for the purpose of your business model, I think it's unethical. If you are really trying to make people's path from A to B in a flow more effective, because you know that that's going to make them happier. I think that, you know, and improve the experience and improve the take that they, you know, or the outcome of their experience and the outcome that they can use for something good. I think that's totally fine. I mean, that's what we do when we do usability enhancements, right? We look at we might see in our data that people drop off here and here and here, but we can't figure out why. So we do a study. We either do a screen recording or we do an actual usability study with people in the room, and we figure out, hey, it's because, you know, this button is placed wrong, or there are too many steps here in this flow, or this doesn't make sense, and then we improve that. I think that's totally fine to do, and I think that's going to really increase people's willingness to use our platform.
But how do you separate one from the other? Because essentially user success is directly linked to our revenue ultimately. If we make the user do their stuff well and that therefore they stay, they don't churn, the users keep paying and the business is flourishing. That's a very direct connection.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. I guess as an ethical experience designer, I would not take on a task. The tool set is very similar. I totally agree. You use the same tools and basically the same methodology to improve an experience in an e-commerce shop and in a learning app. You basically use the same methodology and the same sort of tool set. I know personally that I would rather take on a project with a mission statement and a core value that is ethical, as opposed to taking on a contract that's just, you know, for monetary purposes, and the project that you take on is or the platform that you're working on is for purely for monetization reasons, because the tool set is very, very similar, and you can use the same tool set to improve engagement and all sorts of stuff in an e-commerce as you can in a learning app. There is no difference in the methodology. But the point is, I guess, you can use your skills to improve lives or to improve businesses. And the one doesn't necessarily exclude the other.
Because there are humans, human lives behind the businesses, and the fellow founders are humans as well.
Sure. But I think it's how do I put it? I mean, I personally like to work on stuff that to me matters to me, that matters on a grander scale, and that's where my idealism, you know, comes in, right?
Exactly.
And so yeah, that to me is being ethical in your own business as well.
So before we wrap up today's episode, one last question to you. What would be your top two tips for people who are, you know, doing daily UX practice in order to make their work more impactful towards shifting our universe toward the ethical things?
I would definitely, if I didn't do it already, start working user-centered. So because that implies and that requires you to talk more with the people that you design for and establish empathy. And that, you know, establishing empathy has a lot of good side benefits. So that would be one. The other would be to look at the system that I'm working on with critical eyes and analyze it from top to bottom and establish or identify any black hat areas that it has, and then do, you know, a full reshape of that, or at least a set of suggestions on how to improve that to a more white hat approach. I would definitely do that. I'm looking at the table of contents on the book on White Hat UX. And that's exactly what we're trying to establish. Is first you evaluate, you know, first you evaluate what you do, then you build something that is better than what you have through user-centered design and through continuous testing, and you know, ultimately that improves your product.
That is a wonderful piece of advice. Thank you so much, Trina. This is super valuable. How do people find you and your work online?
So I'm, you know, all over the place. Trina Falbe on Twitter and LinkedIn. And I have my my website with, you know, the carpenter's house is always the last one to get renovated, right? It's, I try to write from now and then on my blog, trinafalbe.com, my website and blog. But I'd say LinkedIn and Twitter is probably the best places to find me and to have good discussions.
Yes, absolutely. And we're also going to link to the book, of course, so that everybody can read up.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome stuff.
Thank you so much, Trina, for sharing your advice. And I hope that your business practices become more and more white hat with the way you grow.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me, Jane. It was a true pleasure.
Thank you, Trina. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.